Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill for Thursday, May 21. The story, GOP senators warn Trump retribution tour hurts president's agenda. President Trump's success in knocking off GOP lawmakers who have defied or criticized him is striking fear among Republicans on Capitol Hill, but some say the retribution tour could backfire on the president by making it tougher to pass his agenda. Trump successfully urged his supporters to defeat Senator Bill Cassidy in the Senate Republican primary in Louisiana on Saturday and rallied voters to oust Representative Thomas Massie, Republican, from his seat in Kentucky's 4th Congressional District on Tuesday. Now it looks like Trump is poised to punish another longtime Republican incumbent, Senator John Cornyn of Texas, who the president said was not supportive of me when times were tough. Trump endorsed Cornyn's primary opponent, State Attorney General Ken Paxton, on Tuesday, giving him a huge boost ahead of next week's primary runoff. GOP senators say Trump has demonstrated his influence with Republican primary voters, but they warn his efforts to torpedo fellow GOP officeholders could make it tougher to pass his agenda. Why are you creating a structural vote count that could prevent you from getting almost anything done with a supermajority going forward, said Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, who warned Trump's beefs with GOP senators could make it very tough to get 60 votes to pass legislative priorities through the upper chamber. Why would anybody think that makes sense? I count votes, he said. Tillis said if Trump costs Cornyn his Senate seat, it could be costly to the president's agenda. I hope to God that John Cornyn wins next week, but if he loses, the president's got a structural 5 or 6 votes in the Senate GOP conference that can't stop anything from a simple majority for the remainder of his term, he said, alluding to GOP colleagues who became more emboldened to block Trump's agenda, especially on controversial items. Asked if there's a growing group of Republican senators who could make it difficult for Trump to push controversial or unpopular legislation, such as legislation to fund the White House ballroom, Tillis responded, yeah. Republican senators alienated by Trump's tactics won't sabotage his agenda out of personal pique, but they'll be less willing to stick their necks out by taking tough votes to pass unpopular legislation or confirm controversial nominees with suspect qualifications. We're being forced to take policy votes that are not helpful to the electorate, Tillis said, citing the pressure to provide up to $1 billion for the construction of a 90,000-square-foot ballroom. Former President Reagan's famous 11th commandment was, "Thou shalt not speak ill of any fellow Republican," and Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, regularly stresses that teamwork is the key to scoring big policy wins. Some Senate Republicans say Trump's salvos against GOP colleagues who have done a lot of heavy lifting to advance the president's agenda are counterproductive and could very well backfire. There's always a consequence associated with taking an incumbent United States senator, Thune told reporters Wednesday. Thune said Trump has every right to endorse the candidates he favors in primaries, but warned that it could complicate securing the votes for his priorities, like the White House ballroom. He obviously has his favorites and people he wants to endorse, and that's his prerogative, but what we have to deal with up here is moving an agenda. Obviously, that can become slightly more complicated, Thune said. Thune had supported the re-election of Cassidy, who chairs the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, and was instrumental in confirming Trump's controversial nominees to key positions such as Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Cassidy also spearheaded the Republican push to replace the Affordable Care Act's expired enhanced health insurance premium subsidies with a plan to establish health savings accounts, an idea that gave Republican senators important political cover during last fall's acrimonious health care fight. Days after Trump spiked the football over his foe's third-place finish in the Louisiana primary, Cassidy became the 4th Republican senator to vote to advance a resolution under the War Powers Act directing Trump to withdraw U.S. troops deployed against Iran. Cassidy, in a statement, said he couldn't support extending the war until the administration provides clarity about what to expect from the conflict. While I support the administration's efforts to dismantle Iran's nuclear program, the White House and Pentagon have left Congress in the dark on Operation Epic Fury, he said. Cassidy also made it clear this week that he would vote against funding for the White House ballroom in the budget reconciliation package and slammed the Trump administration's proposal to set up a legal compensation fund for MAGA allies, such as a slush fund. Thune is also a strong supporter of Cornyn, who played a major role in helping to enact Trump's agenda during his first term as the Senate Republican whip, and has been a loyal soldier in voting to confirm Trump's nominees and enact his tax agenda. Cornyn on Wednesday said he wasn't disappointed in the fact that the president didn't endorse him, but he tried to project confidence. We've got the best team and the best plan of any election I've ever run in, and we're going to turn out the vote and intend to win, he said. Asked how Trump's revenge tour may impact his agenda in Congress, Cornyn said, I'll let you draw your own conclusion about that. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, said Trump has his views and clearly wants to have people he feels will be loyal to him in office. But she quickly added, I'm not suggesting that the president's endorsement of Paxton over a principled, strong, solid lawmaker like John Cornyn is smart at all. He made his decision, and I think that makes things harder in our Republican conference right now, Murkowski said. It makes it harder for his agenda, but it also makes it harder for the Republican team who want to be there to support the president to be doing just that. It's supposed to be something when you're trying to work with one another, not against your own team, and it just kind of felt like he was working against his own team, she said of Trump's endorsement of Paxton. Asked about Trump's harsh attacks on Cassidy, whom the president called a sleazebag, Murkowski said, there's plenty of opposition to go against. Why, again, would you go against any members of your own team? I don't think that it benefits the president at all, she said. I don't understand his calculus on being personally vindictive toward Republican. The story, Emmer manages GOP emotions as whip amid speculation about leadership ambitions. House Majority Whip Tom Emmer, Republican of Minnesota, has a naturally blunt demeanor, but he says a softer touch is the key to wooing rambunctious members in the super slim House Republican majority. Human beings are very emotional animals. If you don't manage the emotions, then you got cleanup to do, Emmer said. That was the task ahead for Emmer when he spoke to the Hill in late April, at the start of a week jam-packed with so many major bills sure to cause friction and looming deadlines that one member dubbed it Hell Week. A number of Republicans made demands, and Emmer didn't discourage them from voicing their positions. I pretty much tell the members, say whatever you want. This is an emotional thing. You got to get it out. Eventually we're going to get you back, Emmer said. By the end of the bumpy week, all the measures in question passed. The number three House Republican is tasked with being the chief vote counter and vote getter for the House GOP legislative agenda under President Trump. His two terms as whip and before that two winning cycles as chair of the National Republican Congressional Committee have allowed him to foster personal relationships across the ideological spectrum of the House Republican Conference, according to a dozen GOP lawmakers and aides who spoke to The Hill. That has made him a top contender for a higher leadership position should Republicans lose control of the House in November and Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, leave leadership. And if not after November, as plenty of members have started to speculate, there is potential for him to rise up further in the future. Emmer brushed off that chatter. I'd like to be the whip. We're going to succeed in November, and I would love the opportunity to come back and get even better at this job, Emmer said, adding that he gets irritated by those in politics who are planning for what they are going to do next. I didn't come here to be somebody. I came here to do something. He pointed to a small sign on his desk in the style of one that once sat on former President Reagan's. There's no limit to what a man can do or where he can go if he doesn't mind who gets the credit. Calling on Trump over the past year and a half, doing something has often meant late-night negotiations with holdouts in the Speaker's office or keeping open a vote for hours as leaders work to flip members on the House floor. And sometimes, as with the One Big Beautiful Bill Act of Trump's tax cut and spending priorities last year, it's required bringing in the president himself as a closer. That dynamic has earned Emmer some criticism. One Republican operative said Emmer was a horrible whip. Everything's whipped by the White House or the Speaker, the operative said. White House Director of Legislative Affairs James Braid, although, had a different assessment. Tom Emmer has played a critical role in advancing the administration's priorities, including delivering the largest tax cut in American history. His leadership and partnership have been instrumental in delivering key votes for the president, and he remains a great ally to the administration, Braid said in a statement. Trump has publicly praised Emmer as a problem solver. When I have a problem, I call him up and he gets it done. He's a tough cookie, Trump said of Emmer at the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, signing on Independence Day last year, suggesting Emmer should run for governor of Minnesota. Emmer also dismissed the criticism. You'll always be able to find someone who says, well, they shouldn't whip that, or the whip's office sucks at this, he said. They're going to say whatever they're going to say because this stupid place is built on this idea that we're in competition. Emmer's relationship with Trump has come leaps and bounds in the past few years, which would be crucial were he to mount a higher leadership position. When Emmer threw his hat in the ring to be Speaker after former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, was ousted in 2023, Trump, despite having a good conversation with Emmer in the days before, blasted Emmer as a globalist rhino who was totally out of touch with Republican voters. Emmer withdrew his nomination for Speaker hours later. The two got to know each other better over the next year, and his standing in Trump world skyrocketed. By fall 2024, Emmer was prepping then-Senator J.D. Vance, Republican of Ohio, for the vice presidential debate, playing Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, Democrat, in mock debates. And now, in a letter to Trump, book of photos and messages to the president from world leaders and celebrities, sits on a coffee table in Emmer's office. Staying cool in the chaos, Emmer was remarkably cool ahead of a week that included contentious votes on reauthorizing foreign spy powers, passing a bill to fund the bulk of the Department of Homeland Security, and advancing a separate measure to fund immigration enforcement, and passing the Farm Bill, despite member demands over amendments and niche issues. It's kind of like the NHL playoffs, right? Said Emmer, a former hockey coach, in late April interview. Everybody's complaining that two of the top teams, Dallas and Minnesota, have to play each other in the first round. Well, guess what? You got to beat them all anyway if you're going to get to where you're going. The vote schedule, Emmer said, is the same thing. Weeks he thought in the past might be easy turned out to be drama-filled headaches, such as Crypto Week last year, when uproar over one provision led to the longest vote in House history, breaking the record that was set the week before. That kind of floor drama was once a rarity and an indication of major disorder, but it has become commonplace in the two-vote majority, where public rebellion has become part of the party's culture. But Emmer said the carefully choreographed votes of the past, when leaders had greater room for error, came with their own downsides. The idea that, oh, it was so peaceful back then, no, it was worse, Emmer said. He recalled being in a monthly meeting for the first-term members in 2015, when then-Speaker John Boehner, Republican of Ohio, sat up front smoking a cigarette and drinking Diet Coke. Representative Buddy Carter, Republican of Georgia, spoke up to say he could not vote to raise the debt ceiling. Boehner responded, "You'll be voting to raise the debt ceiling. That kind of strong-arming doesn't work anymore. It's not our job to tell them what to do. It's our job to figure out what they can and can't do and then advise Steve Scalise and Mike Johnson ahead of time. This is what you're going to be encountering, Emmer said. Sometimes they take that, sometimes they don't. The leadership teams are far more collegial and collaborative than in years past, Aide said. Emmer said he has only been truly caught off guard by a vote loss on the floor once. In January, a handful of moderate Republicans voted with Democrats to kill a series of GOP labor bills. That agony of defeat is what drives Emmer more than the thrill of winning. The feeling of failing is the worst feeling you will ever have. You'll learn more from it, but it's the worst feeling. April's Foreign Spy Powers reauthorization vote was a prime example of members' emotions complicating key votes. Several members demanding changes had rocky personal histories with intelligence agencies, including Representative Scott Perry, Republican of Pennsylvania, whose personal cell phone was seized by the FBI in 2022 as part of the Justice Department's investigation into January 6, 2021, and efforts to reverse the 2020 election. Perry downplayed the significance of Emmer's emotional management role, even as he praised the whip. "I don't need a counselor. I can read," Perry said. "We just need to do the right thing around here, and we're not just going to be rolled by anybody." Emmer said that his communication has gotten better over his time in Congress. He thought he already had that skill given his track record trying to crank cases as an attorney, but he said in the congressional venue he was a terrible communicator. "Here you're not the lawyer, you're the witness, and it took me years to figure out how to be the witness," Emmer said. Carter, for his part, agreed that current leadership is more engaged with members individually, and while they might not tell members how to vote, they have their own way of changing your mind. "These days, one of the hardest parts of the whip job is members' absences. People have lives, they get health issues, they have family issues, they've got different things going on, and they can't make it at work all the time," Emmer said. Emmer's record, the sense that Emmer was too moderate, thwarted his short-lived speaker bid in 2023 when members dinged Emmer for his 2022 vote in favor of a bill to codify same-sex marriage, and bubbled up at the end of last year when right-wing social media influencers brought up his comments from 2015 saying Somali immigrants were some of the fastest assimilating populations. Emmer said his vote for the Respect for Marriage Act was a tough decision, but a technical one due to its provisions protecting religious liberty for those who did not want to facilitate same-sex marriage. Emmer feared that if Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, Democrat, went after the Catholic school his kids went to for not teaching all forms of marriage, any legal arguments he made pointing to the religious liberty provisions in the law would be undermined if he voted against the bill. "I disagreed with my church, too, which I think I'm right still," Emmer said of the vote. As for the posts about his Somali comments, Emmer said those come from those who must view me as a rival, as a danger, so they tried to seed the clouds with partial information. Emmer teamed up with Ellison, then a member of the House, to start the House Somali Caucus in 2015, which he said Ellison pitched to him as a way to help the Somali youth assimilate. "I was very worried about the radicalization of especially young males because we aren't bringing them into our community," Emmer said, but he said it was clear that within months that Ellison was using it for something else, and Emmer immediately went the opposite direction, co-sponsoring a bill to give Congress more oversight of the refugee program and voting against funding for refugee resettlement. Emmer in December called for denaturalization and deportation of Somalis who were convicted in a fraud scheme, and in January became a member of the Sharia Free America Caucus, Fierce Loyalty and Trust. Emmer places a premium on trust and knows his members do too. "I don't trust people right away," Emmer said. "Once they prove it, though, we are teammates. You're going to do what you do, and I will back you up." Often, Emmer said, his team will not share the details of some members' personal situations, even with Johnson and House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, Republican of Louisiana, who might find out about these situations later, if at all. We respect the privacy of the members, and I think they trust us because of it, Emmer said. That fierce loyalty translates to his staff, too. When McCarthy led the House GOP, a misunderstanding between staff became a disagreement between the leaders. McCarthy did not want to a certain Emmer staffer in the room for a high-level regular meeting. Emmer in turn told McCarthy that he would not come to another one of those meetings until the staffer was allowed. McCarthy and Emmer became close. The most important thing I can say about Tom is you can trust him, Perry said. He might not agree with you, but he'll be straight with you, and that's really all you can ask for. Representative Mike Alford, Republican of Missouri, whose office is next to Emmer's in the Cannon House building, said he often has Emmer and other Republican neighbors from the floor in his office to enjoy cigars and bourbon and enjoy transparent conversation. It beats being here then over at the bar at Capitol Hill Club, Alford said. A lot of people are out every night of the week. Emmer summed up his approach as whip, communication, and respect. That's all this is. The story: Trump's primary push could leave him with short-term problem in Congress. President Trump has spent the past several months working to reshape the Republican Party, backing primary challenges against lawmakers who have bucked him and seeking to fill Congress with allies who will advance his agenda with minimal resistance. But even as Trump has flexed his power of his endorsement in GOP primaries, the effort comes with a short-term complication. Several of the defeated or retiring incumbents he's targeted remain in office until the end of their terms. Those lawmakers who no longer face voters and have little political incentive to fall in line could make things difficult for Trump and GOP leaders as they feel more emboldened to push back against key partisan legislation. In a narrowly divided Congress, even a handful of GOP defections can derail a party-line bill. And all of this comes as Republicans confront a packed legislative agenda in the weeks ahead, working to push through an immigration funding package and a third reconciliation bill with no Democratic support, and a long-term extension of the Foreign Intelligence, Surveillance Acts, or FISA warrantless spying powers, all while aiming to show voters they are addressing affordability concerns and delivering results as the midterm election cycle ramps up. Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana, who voted to convict Trump in 2021 and lost to Trump-backed challenger Representative Julia Letlow, Republican of Louisiana, and Louisiana State Treasurer John Fleming in the state's Senate GOP primary on Saturday, wasted no time in flexing his new political freedom. He was one of four Republican senators to join Democrats in advancing a war powers resolution aimed at limiting Trump's military action in Iran without congressional approval. Cassidy had not previously voted in favor of such a measure. Tuesday's vote marked the eighth time since the start of the war that the Senate has voted on a motion to advance a resolution, but it marked the first time that such a motion advanced. Cassidy also called the Trump administration's creation of a $1.8 billion fund to compensate people who claim they were targeted by the Biden Justice Department a slush fund, and has opposed a provision in an immigration funding package that would provide $1 billion in security funds for the new White House ballroom and other Secret Service priorities. In a sense, he's following the lead of Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, who announced his retirement as he faced Trump's wrath for voting against the Big Beautiful Bill last year and has since become a vocal critic of many of the administration's moves. Representative Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, who was defeated by Trump-backed candidate Ed Gallrein on Tuesday night, has also long been a thorn in Trump's side, and he's shown no signs of backing down either. He led the effort to force the administration to release files related to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and backed several war powers resolutions. He also voted against Trump One's Big Beautiful Bill Act last year. In his concession speech, Massie slammed Trump's decision to build a White House ballroom, arguing that while gas is almost $5 and diesel's almost $6, they're talking about this big ballroom they're going to build. Even so, Trump is continuing his revenge tour against other political opponents, endorsing Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton over incumbent Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, for the Texas Senate GOP primary, and calling for a primary opponent against Representative Lauren Boebert, Republican of Colorado, after she campaigned for Massey, though the window to enter the Colorado race has already closed. Trump also threatened centrist Representative Brian Fitzpatrick, Republican of Pennsylvania, saying he likes voting against Trump. You know what happens with that. It doesn't work out well. Fitzpatrick voted against the One Big Beautiful Bill Act last year, has supported a short-term extension of the now-expired Affordable Care Act subsidies, introduced a War Powers Resolution himself, and broken with Trump on several other issues. Representative Don Bacon, Republican of Nebraska, who's retiring at the end of his term, said that Republicans should be able to speak freely, and if the president doesn't like it, don't bully. Try to persuade us. He's lost the art of persuasion, and he's bullying, and most Americans don't respond well to that. When you bully me, I'm like, watch this, I hate to see the attack on independence, Bacon said. Bacon, however, added that Trump doesn't always get his way. He campaigned against me in 22 and against our governor, sitting governor, so I mean, in the end, you got to make your case and you can prevail, Bacon said. Other Republicans have largely dismissed concerns that Trump's primary challenge threats are sending a warning sign that there's no space in the GOP for dissent, arguing that the president is entitled to weigh in on races and that Massey's case was an outlier. I feel complete freedom to say whatever I think, and I've disagreed with the president. I usually go talk to him when I disagree with him. I don't go on social media or whatever, but I found President Trump very open to counter-arguments and input from members, so I don't think it's an issue of are you towing that line. I think it's an issue where the president felt like Thomas Massey had opposed him on a number of important things and decided to weigh in. Representative Richard Hudson, Republican of North Carolina, chair of the National Republican Congressional Committee, said. Representative Ralph Norman, Republican of South Carolina, a member of the far-right House Freedom Caucus, said that Trump goes after people who, for the most part, vote just irrationally. I mean, he's got good. Donald Trump saved his country with his policies, and if you don't go along with his policies, he should come after you, Norman said. Representative Kevin Kiley, independent of California, who caucuses with Republicans, said that Trump has every right to participate in elections, as you know, as he chooses. Asked whether the message for Republicans is that they need to be in lockstep with the president or face defeat, Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, argued in a Wednesday press briefing that the GOP's priorities are centered around the America First agenda. We need people here who understand that, who are not, you know, trying to carve out their own lane and do something that's destructive or, you know, counterproductive, I think, to the agenda. And that's what happened, Johnson said. Johnson said that he'd never ask Republicans to violate a core principle, but they have to. You have to. You have to give up on some of your personal preferences sometimes because you're in a deliberative body and you have 434 colleagues, okay, other people. So that's the message. It's nothing more than that, he added. The story, Massey allies and foes say primary loss was practically inevitable. No matter their relationship with Representative Thomas Massey, Republican of Kentucky, House Republicans on Wednesday largely concurred on one thing. The Kentucky Republicans' primary loss on Tuesday was practically inevitable. President Trump's the captain of the team, and when you fight the captain, you're going to end up getting thrown off the team. I think that's what happened. First-term Representative Randy Fine, Republican of Florida, who has vehemently disagreed with Massey in the past, told The Hill on Wednesday before heading into House Republicans' weekly conference meeting. Massey, who has represented the Bluegrass State's 4th Congressional District for more than a decade, lost to the Trump-backed Ed Gallrein by more than 9 points Tuesday. The race was yet another example of Trump's grip on the GOP base as the president embarks on a retribution tour against lawmakers he feels have defied him. Massey, perhaps even more than Trump's other targets, has repeatedly and loudly broken with the party on issues such as U.S. foreign policy, the Jeffrey Epstein files, and Trump's signature tax and spending law. Even those who count Massey as a friend, such as Representative Tim Burkett, Republican of Tennessee, acknowledged Wednesday that the Kentuckians' defeat is the cost of doing business. "I hate losing friends up here because I don't have very many," Burkett said, but politics is a blood sport, and you better put your cup on if you want to come up here in this league because it is rough. Massey has long been a contrarian in the Republican caucus, criticizing the federal government's warrantless surveillance program and U.S. military endeavors abroad. He lives on his cattle farm in a house he built himself. But after Trump returned to office, Massey's penchant for defying the rest of his conference earned him a powerful enemy in the White House. Massey was one of just two Republicans in the House, along with moderate Representative Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, to vote against the One Big Beautiful Bill Act last July. While the Kentucky Republican argued the legislation would add to the national debt, a claim the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office agreed with in August, Trump said at the time that he would support a primary challenger to ensure Massey would be reduced to history. Add in Massey's leading role in enacting the Epstein Files Transparency Act, along with his criticism of the president's foreign policy decisions and the U.S. allegiance with Israel writ large, and it was clear that another term would be an uphill battle. President Trump won overwhelmingly 2 years ago, Fine said. "The American people expect us to get his agenda done, and Massey did everything in his power to defeat that agenda." Representative Rick Allen, Republican of Georgia, said Wednesday that while he admired Massey's courage, the Kentucky Republican ultimately was not there for House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, when it counted. "At some point in time, you've got to respect authority," Allen noted. "The speaker makes the calls. It's a team sport." The Georgia Republican later added, "It takes 218 to pass legislation. Those folks with courage, I don't mind them making their argument, but if the party can't get 218 votes, they need to come over and vote with us." Johnson, during his Wednesday press conference, said that while he was not involved in Massey's primary, he was not surprised by the results in that district, and he echoed Allen's point. Asked later whether the message for Republicans was that they needed to fall in line, Johnson responded, "We need people here who understand that, who are not, trying to carve out their own lane and do something that's destructive or counterproductive, I think, to the agenda, and that's what happened." Massey is not the only congressional Republican Trump worked to oust in recent days. Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana, who voted to convict the president following the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, lost his primary to Trump-backed candidates, Representative Julia Letlow, Republican of Louisiana, and Louisiana Treasurer John Fleming, Republican, over the weekend, while five Indiana state senators who opposed mid-decade redistricting lost their primaries earlier this month to challengers the president endorsed. Trump on Tuesday also endorsed Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton over Senator John Cornyn in the upcoming Texas Senate GOP primary, infuriating some of Cornyn's colleagues in the upper chamber. While it is too early to tell whether those results will dissuade other Republicans from publicly disagreeing with Trump, Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, said the message is clear on what they indicate. "Ask anyone who hasn't been endorsed by President Trump when it comes to a Republican primary, and they'll tell you his endorsement's the best and most important one ever," Jordan told reporters. Retiring Representative Don Bacon, Republican of Nebraska, meanwhile, bemoaned Wednesday that the president is targeting sitting members of Congress. "We're an independent branch, and we shouldn't be yes men. By no means, we shouldn't be an echo chamber to the president. In fact, when we do that, it's worse for the president. We should be a check and balance and help form even better policy," said Bacon, a moderate Republican who often disagrees with Massey on policy, but has also broken with the president, including on the issue of Ukraine. "We should be able to speak freely, and if the president doesn't like it, Don't bully, try to persuade us, he said later. He's lost the art of persuasion. He's bullying, and most Americans don't respond well to that. Yet some Republicans said it was possible to disagree with Trump, just not to the extent Massey had. I found with President Trump to go to him with my disagreements and tell him what I disagree with him about, and we've had some nice compromises in the past, Burkett recalled. Massey, on the other hand, often appeared for TV interviews and took to social media to criticize the Justice Department's handling of the Epstein files. He doesn't like surprises, Burkett added, referring to Trump. Representative Richard Hudson, Republican of North Carolina, the head of the House GOP campaign arm, said he feels complete freedom to say what he thinks. So I don't think it's an issue of, are you towing that line? I think it's an issue where the president felt like Thomas Massie had opposed him on a number of important things and decided to weigh in, he added. Bacon and Fine, while differing in their reactions to Massie's loss, both criticized the Kentucky lawmaker for quipping Tuesday that Gallrein was in Tel Aviv. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and other pro-Israel groups spent millions in support of Gallrein, a retired Navy SEAL, whose campaign received roughly $2.4 million less in contributions than that of Massey, according to the Federal Election Commission. Fine, who is Jewish, said Wednesday that Massey is a vicious anti-Semite and that he was proud Trump took him out. Good riddance, remarked Fine, who said in February he would choose dogs over Muslims. Bacon said that while he likes Massey on a personal level, his colleague's use of anti-Israel, anti-Jewish language was very disgusting. The Nebraska Republican added, there's no place in the Republican Party for anti-Semitism, and he crossed the line. The story, five big obstacles Kevin Warsh faces as Federal Reserve Chair. Kevin Warsh will face a political and economic obstacle course upon taking the helm of the Federal Reserve later this week. Warsh is set to be sworn in by President Trump on Friday as the next chair of the Fed board, taking over the central bank at a pivotal time for the U.S. economy. After years raging against outgoing Fed chair Jerome Powell, Trump made clear before Warsh's nomination that he would only consider candidates he could trust to cut interest rates. Spiking inflation and divides among Fed officials, however, could make it impossible for Warsh to appease the president while fulfilling his duties as Fed chair. Kevin Warsh is about to begin his tenure as Federal Reserve Chair with what some believe is a mandate from the president to cut rates, said Joe Brusselas, chief economist at RSM. But the recent rise in market-based break-even inflation rates strongly implies that Warsh and the Federal Open Market Committee will have to prepare for the chance that inflation will continue to rise and that the Fed will have to shift its policy. Here are the major obstacles Warsh faces upon taking office. Trump's political pressure. Looming over any shift in the economic or financial sector facing the Fed is Trump's clear insistence that the U.S. interest rates should already be lower. The Fed's refusal to zero out interest rates during most of Trump's first term was the president's primary gripe with Powell, a Republican whom Trump nominated to chair the Fed in 2017. Despite Trump's previous comments, Warsh insisted that the president did not ask him to commit to cutting rates and pledged to make decisions based on the state of the economy. Trump also waved off concerns about his potential pressure earlier this week, telling reporters that Warsh would be allowed to do what he wants to do. He's a very talented guy, Trump said. He's going to be fine. He's going to do a good job. Trump's latest remarks, however, are out of line with his previous commitments to picking a Fed chief who would slash rates. When teasing his upcoming Fed chair nomination in December, Trump said his pick would be someone who believes in lower interest rates by a lot. Trump also said in April he would be disappointed in Warsh if the Fed did not cut interest rates immediately upon him taking office. We should have the lowest interest rates in the world, Trump said in an April interview with CNBC. Iran inflation spike. Trump's desire for lower interest rates is unlikely to be satisfied as the war in Iran pushes prices even higher. The annual inflation rate surged to 3.8% in April as measured by the Labor Department's Consumer Price Index, or CPI, hitting the highest level in 3 years. Producer prices also rose in April at the fastest rate in nearly 3 years, deepening concerns about inflation. Warsh has suggested that much of the Iran-driven inflation surge is from temporary increases in fuel and food costs that would reverse whenever the conflict eases. Top administration officials have also insisted that prices would begin to fall once the Strait of Hormuz is reopened. But with no end to the conflict in sight, the Fed will likely be forced to hold steady with rates, if not raise them, for the foreseeable future. These hotter-than-expected inflation reports leave the incoming chair facing renewed questions about price stability and the timing of any policy easing, wrote Christian Floro, market strategist at Principal Asset Management. For investors, the risk is rising that it will be 2027 before they see any further policy easing from the Fed. Smaller workforce, higher tariffs. Before the Iran war broke out in February, the Fed was attempting to understand how to manage an economy with a much smaller workforce and higher import taxes. Trump's steep cuts to immigration and increases in deportations helped take more than 600,000 people out of the U.S. labor force over the past year, according to Labor Department data. Job gains have also fallen sharply since Trump took office in January 2025, with little net increase during his second administration. The simultaneous declines in job seekers and open jobs helped keep unemployment from surging during the second Trump administration, with just a 0.3 percentage point increase since the start of Trump's latest term. The job market, to my eye, has been pretty stable. It might not be good, but it has been stable. And the inflation has not been stable, said Austin Goolsbee, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, in a Monday interview on Fox Business Network. Goolsbee added that inflation appeared to be rising in areas not necessarily connected to the Iran war, complicating the picture even further for Warsh. Namely, services inflation is high and rising, so that's probably not coming from oil. It's probably coming from tariffs, Goolsbee said. There are going to be a lot of things on the radar screen, and we could use some guidance here from the chair. Divides among Fed officials, the economy is not the only unprecedentedly complicated challenge Warsh will face Friday. Warsh is inheriting control of a Federal Open Market Committee, or FOMC, that has been unusually polarized over the past 2 years. As chair of the FOMC, Warsh is the leader of the Fed's key interest rate setting panel and wields significant influence over its discussions about the economy. But Warsh is but one of 12 votes on monetary policy, meaning he must be able to drive consensus among other members to achieve his preferred outcomes. Doing so has been even harder in recent months. The FOMC voted to keep rates steady in May by an 8-4 vote, the first time since 1992 more than three officials opposed a rate move. We doubt that Fed Chair Warsh can deliver President Trump's desired rate cuts if incoming data are not supportive, wrote Steve Englander and John Davies, strategist at Standard Chartered Bank, in a research note. He can limit or delay FOMC hikes, though not indefinitely, if the data point to rising inflation. Legal battles. Warsh will also lead the Fed as it faces several legal challenges brought by the Trump administration, including the apparent winding down of the criminal probe into Powell. The Fed is also bracing for the Supreme Court's ruling on whether the White House was allowed to fire Fed Board member Lisa Cook, a decision with serious implications for Fed independence. The story is the Hill's Morning Report. How low can Trump's poll numbers go? In today's issue, GOP skepticism of Trump rises, Castro indicted in escalation of Cuba tensions, Senate parliamentarian in crosshairs, difficulties of Trump primary success. President Trump's approval rating is hitting new lows for his second term as the Iran war and surging prices rankle voters, raising questions about just how much it could fall with the midterm elections approaching. Trump has never been a particularly popular president throughout either of his terms in office. He only briefly had a net positive approval rating in the Decision Desk HQ, or DDHQ polling average, for his second term, and his numbers have often trailed those of other presidents at comparable points in their administrations. His rating has also been remarkably steady, usually fluctuating between the low to mid-40s, despite wins or controversies that may have had more of an effect on the ratings for his predecessors. But that's been put to the test in recent weeks as Trump's approval rating has floated barely above 40% and even fallen below that at times. The DDHQ average currently has his approval rating at 39.7% and his disapproval rating at 57.6%, near the lowest and highest marks of his current term, respectively. That's been fueled by multiple recent polls released from major pollsters, showing his numbers taking a dive, especially as more Americans say they aren't satisfied with Trump's handling of the economy. A Quinnipiac University poll released Wednesday showed one of his lowest ratings recorded so far, finding only 34% of respondents approved of his job performance. Only a third said they approve of his handling of the economy. The results were split along partisan lines, with nearly all Democrats disapproving of him on the economy and an overwhelming majority of Republicans in approval. But there was a significant shift within the president's party. Only 73% of Republicans said they approve of Trump's handling of the economy, while almost a quarter disapprove. That's a significant change from Quinnipiac's poll last month, when 88% of Republicans approved of the president on the issue. What was perhaps the signature issue that propelled Trump to winning two elections sours with voters and cracks form in GOP enthusiasm for his handling of the economy, Quinnipiac polling analyst Tim Molloy said in a release. A survey from the Associated Press NORC Center also released Wednesday found a similar result. Pollsters found 37% of adults approve of Trump's job performance, including 72% of Republicans. Only 63% of Republican respondents said they approved of his handling of the economy, down from 78% at the start of his second term. The results come as gas prices are reaching new highs almost 3 months into the Iran war. Prices now top $4 per gallon in all 50 states, with the national average at $4.56 per gallon, according to AAA. The president's average approval rating still hasn't reached its lowest mark ever recorded. He fell to just above 37% in Real Clear Politics average in December 2017. A Gallup poll taken earlier that year found that most Trump disapprovers felt alienated by his personality and character, not his policies. Looking to past presidents, there's still plenty of room for Trump to fall, especially if inflation keeps going up and Iran becomes a quagmire. Harry Truman notched the lowest approval rating for a president in Gallup's history at 22% amid frustration over the Korean War and the economy. George W. Bush sunk to 25% during the 2008 financial crisis and Iraq War, and Jimmy Carter fell to 28% amid an energy crisis and soaring gas prices. While Trump's MAGA base has inured him from those types of numbers in the past, that's showing signs of erosion too. The Wednesday AP NORC Center poll found only 18% of voters strongly approve of his performance, down 6 points from roughly the same time last year. While the president seems destined to set personal lows in the months ahead without some major change in his handling of the economy and Iran war, he's still far away from Truman territory, but also less than halfway into his second term. Even his current numbers are a huge concern to Republicans 6 months out from the midterms, with his falling approving coinciding with a widening gap in the generic ballot for congressional races. The multiracial coalition of voters who helped his return to the White House is quickly cracking, with support from Black and Latino voters plummeting. Approval numbers that once seemed impossible for Trump, low 30s or high 20s, no longer seem so far-fetched. Smart take with Blake Berman. The Department of Justice announced a 7-count indictment against Cuba's Raul Castro, stemming from the murder of Americans 30 years ago. This indictment comes as the administration continues to pressure the communist regime, which includes an oil blockade on the island nation. Senator Rick Scott, Republican of Florida, told me what he thinks will happen next. "We're going to see democracy in Cuba," he said. As for potential U.S. military action, Scott told me, "I don't think we're going to have to do it. I think what's going to happen is we've seen the Cuban people rise up, and that's why there's political prisoners right now. We've seen the Cuban people rise up because they have no food, no electricity." Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche said this isn't a show indictment, adding that Castro will show up here by his own will or by another way. What remains to be seen is that if the other way is reminiscent of what we saw in the January operation to apprehend Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro, or if there is some other mechanism. Three things to know. Vanessa Trump, the ex-wife of Donald Trump Jr., announced she has been diagnosed with breast cancer. She and Trump were married for about 13 years and share 5 children. A federal judge has ordered the administration to comply with the Presidential Records Act, rejecting an opinion from the Department of Justice that law is unconstitutional. The judge gave until Tuesday for his order to take effect. Stephen Colbert will host his last episode of The Late Show today, which will air this evening. The series is coming to an end after more than 3 decades on CBS. Leading the day, Castro wanted. The Trump administration ramped up its pressure campaign on the Cuban regime as the Department of Justice, or DOJ, unveiled an indictment against former Cuban President Raul Castro on Wednesday. The charges against Castro, the younger brother of the late Cuban leader, Fidel Castro, include murder and conspiracy to kill U.S. citizens. They were unsealed in tandem with Cuba's Independence Day, recognizing the island nation's freedom from Spanish rule more than a century ago. The indictment stems from a 1996 incident in which 2 small planes flown by members of a U.S.-based group were shot down by the Cuban Air Force, killing 4. 3 of them were U.S. citizens. The planes had been searching for potential refugees looking to leave Cuba for the U.S. Though Castro stepped down as president in 2018, he is still considered to be the de facto leader of the country. The DOJ announcement also raised further speculation that the U.S. may invade Cuba, The Hill's Ellen Mitchell and Rebecca Beitsch report. "This isn't a show indictment," Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche told the reporters. "We expect that he will show up here by his own will or by another way." As part of its pressure campaign, the Trump administration has imposed an oil embargo on the country. It has resulted in wide-ranging blackouts for much of the population. Trump also hasn't ruled out military action, though negotiations between the administration and the regime have been ongoing. Cuban President Miguel Diaz-Canel slammed the indictment against Castro as a pretext for an invasion. "This is a political maneuver devoid of any legal foundation, aimed solely at padding the fabricated dossier they used to justify the folly of a military aggression against Cuba," he wrote in a post on the social platform X. Targeting the referee, Trump turned on the Senate parliamentarian on Wednesday, suggesting Republicans should force her out after she ruled against the inclusion of security funding for a White House ballroom in the GOP's reconciliation bill. "Over the years, she has been brutal to Republicans, but not to the Democrats, so why has she not been replaced?" Trump said in a post on Truth Social. In her role as parliamentarian, one of Elizabeth McDonough's responsibilities is to determine whether certain provisions can be included in reconciliation, a process through which legislation can pass the Senate with a simple majority rather than needing at least 60 votes. McDonough ruled over the weekend that the inclusion of security funding for the ballroom in legislation to finance immigration enforcement agencies violated the Byrd rule, which prohibits provisions that aren't budgetary from being passed under reconciliation. McDonough has previously made rulings that have upset both Republicans and Democrats. Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama, called for McDonough to be fired over her rulings, but Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, has said McDonough's rulings should be respected. Trump's comments came as the Senate Budget Committee advanced the reconciliation bill to fund immigration enforcement through 2029, setting up votes on the Senate floor potentially this week. Pushing back, police officers who defended the Capitol during the January 6, 2021 attack have filed a lawsuit seeking to block the creation of an anti-weaponization fund set up to pay Trump allies who claim they were targets of political prosecution. The fund was created as part of a settlement in which Trump agreed to drop a lawsuit against the IRS for the leaking of his tax returns in 2019. The agency is also permanently barred from auditing Trump's old tax returns under the agreement. But the fund faces both legal and political challenges ahead, The Hill's Mallory Wilson reports. The lawsuit from former U.S. Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn and Metropolitan Police Department Officer Daniel Hodges argued the slush fund is the most brazen act of presidential corruption this century. Democrats have denounced the fund as an abuse of power, and even some Republicans have expressed opposition or uneasiness. "We're going to try to kill it," Representative Brian Fitzpatrick, Republican of Pennsylvania, told reporters. Thune told reporters that he's not a big fan of the fund. Internal rebuke. The Colorado Democratic Party has censured Governor Jared Polis, Democrat, over his decision to grant clemency to former elections clerk Tina Peters, clearing the way for her release from prison at the start of next month. The party's central committee approved a resolution Wednesday declaring Polis's action set a dangerous and disappointing precedent at a time when democracy and voting rights are under attack across the nation. "Weakening accountability for someone convicted of undermining that trust is a mistake," the party said in a statement. "There are real cases that deserve the governor's attention and action. This is not one of them." Polis announced last week that he would commute Peters' sentence by half, yielding the condemnations from his fellow Democrats. The governor has argued that Peters' 9-year sentence for illegally granting an election denier access to voting equipment was excessive. Trump had sought to pressure Polis to release Peters for months, but Polis denied he played a role in the decision. And finally, it's Thursday, which means it's time for the weekly news quiz. Tonight will mark the last episode of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, so this week's quiz will cover some of the history of the show and Colbert. Be sure to email your responses to jgans@thehill.com. Please add quiz to your subject line. Winners who submit correct answers will receive deserved newsletter fame on Friday. Roughly how many episodes of The Late Show under David Letterman and Colbert have aired? 2,500, 4,000, 6,000, or 8,500? Who was the first guest to appear on Colbert's iteration of the show? George Clooney, Bill Murray, David Letterman, or Jon Stewart? Who is the theater where the show is filmed named after? Dick Clark, Jack Parr, Milton Berle, or Ed Sullivan? During which president's administration did Colbert deliver his famous speech at the White House Correspondents Association dinner? Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, or Donald Trump?